morning. Please be seated. The first case on the calendar is State v. Reeves.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephanie Bale. I represent the petitioner, Mr. Reeves. I'm hoping to make 2 points.
Would you like to reserve any time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Two.
I'm hoping to make 2 points on argument today and also discuss this state's statement of additional authorities that was filed on Friday. Don't know if you've had a chance to review that yet. This case concerns the interpretation of our state's medical cannabis laws, specifically whether RCW 6951A040 provides qualified patients arrest protection and decriminalizes the qualified possession of medical cannabis, or whether it merely provides an affirmative defense. The trial court held that it merely provided an affirmative defense and denied Mr. Reese's motion to suppress. This decision was an error for 2 reasons. First, the decision is contrary to the plain and unambiguous language of the statute. And second, if we were to see that there was an ambiguity in our state's medical cannabis laws, according to the rule of lenity, it must be construed strictly against the state and in favor of the accused, Mr. Reese. I'll also be addressing the recent decision in the Court of Appeals, Division 3, State v. Ellis. Before we get started into the legal arguments, though, I want to step back and look at this issue through the eyes of a qualified patient, not through the eyes of a judge, not through the eyes of an attorney, but through the eyes of a patient.
Well, I guess the question is, how do you get to be a qualified patient?
So a qualified patient is somebody who's, I mean, generally you could say they're in compliance with the terms and conditions of the chapter, which means they've been diagnosed with one of the enumerated medical conditions provided for in the chapter, and that they have valid authorizations from their healthcare professional that says they would benefit from the use of medical cannabis.
So there's no requirement to register?
No, there is no requirement to register. And that goes to the plain and unambiguous language of the statute. I first, which we can touch upon, through the eyes of a patient, kind of step back, stop looking at the arguments for a second. If you were diagnosed with cancer and your oncologist told you that you would benefit from the medical use of cannabis, it would be scary, right? Most patients have never used marijuana before. If you went to the language of the statute, you would read, humanitarian compassion necessitates that the decision to use cannabis by patients with terminal or debilitating medical conditions is a personal individual decision. And therefore, the legislature intends that qualifying patients shall not be arrested, prosecuted, or subjected to other criminal sanctions.
Isn't that section vetoed?
No, that's the legislative intent that's in RCW 6951A005.
Okay.
Then you would go on and read under 040, the medical use of cannabis in accordance with the terms and conditions of this chapter does not constitute a crime, and a qualifying patient or designated provider in compliance with the terms and conditions of this chapter may not be arrested. If I were to go on and continue to read that statute, I'd read something about a state registry for the Department of Health for qualified patients. I'd call the Department of Health, or I'd continue to read that provision was vetoed by the governor. So what would the average patient think? That if they choose to bring in 6 plants into their home, that they're committing a crime, or if they're compliant with the prevailing terms and conditions of the chapter, they're protected? I believe they'd think they were protected and they were not committing a crime.
What part of the purpose statute, the 005 statute, was in the act prior to the 2011 amendments?
I'd have to go back and look.
The bill had 2 purpose sections. One was to amend the existing purpose section. The other was the purpose of the actual act.
Yeah.
The governor vetoed the section 101, which was the purpose of the actual act.
Yeah.
So of what you read, it's difficult for me to answer your rhetorical question with regard to what would the patient think without knowing what would the patient have thought in 2010 based what was in the law.
The law at that time.
Your argument not being that it was legal in 2010.
That's right. At that time, there was no discussion about arrest protection, and there was no statement that it does not constitute a crime. It very clearly said it was only an affirmative defense. This change in 2011 was a reflection of the decision in State v. Frye, and it was a directly response to that in order to provide the additional protection of arrest
protection. Did the governor indicate in her veto message why she vetoed Section 101 but not Section 102?
If you go back and look at that veto material, it refers to the overall statutory scheme that regulated medical cannabis through the Department of Health. So it refers to that those regulations, and I think she felt like that referral. I mean, I'd have to go back and look at the exact intent language.
Doesn't she also say that because she could only veto by section, she did not want to veto parts, language that appeared in parts of statutes, because she did not want to eliminate the affirmative defense?
She does mention that in her governor's veto message, that she did not want to eliminate the affirmative defense, yes. I think it's helpful then to look and see, well, how does our courts then look
at
language?
Well, let's continue on here then. It's clear that the legislature, the House and the Senate, had a goal for what they wanted. Can the governor veto sections of a bill such that it leaves a bill that can be enacted as a statute, even though it does not meet the goals set forth in that bill by the legislature? In other words, can the governor, through veto, change the goals?
Yeah, our Constitution says that they can, you know, we used to have this affirmative negative treatment and review of vetoes, and we've since said you can just remove a section. But when they remove a section, it's as if that section was never written into the law. And any reference to a vetoed material is also vetoed. So any reference to Section 901 and the state registry is deleted from the statute as if it never was written into the bill and never considered by the legislature. So when we go back...
Well, it's enacted, though.
The
language appears in the bill as enacted because the governor did not veto it.
But the reference is manifestly obsolete. If you go back and look at Shelton Hotel.
That's your position. How do we determine whether something is manifestly obsolete? By reference to legislative intent? Or do we determine it by simply looking at the plain words, which would have them there? Or do we determine it in some other fashion?
I would say that once the registry was vetoed, it no longer is a term and condition of the chapter. A term and condition is something that you can comply with. It's been removed. It's as if the legislature never considered it.
Is that consistent with the governor's view of the bill as it existed after she exercised her veto power?
The governor's veto message is simply legislative history. It's the opinion of one legislature. It doesn't overrule the fact that we have the rule of lenity.
It's the opinion of 33 legislators, right?
Well, or a single legislator, just like a... Thank you for your time.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is James Wissman, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County. I'm representing the state of Washington today. This court should hold that the officer seeking a search warrant for a marijuana grow operation need not first establish that the grower is a medical marijuana patient or provider to establish probable cause. The growing of medicinal marijuana is illegal, but subject to the exceptions in the Medical Marijuana Act and affirmative defenses. Reese's argument fails for four basic reasons. One, it defeats the intent of both the legislature and the governor. Two, it brings about a law that nobody wanted that gives blanket immunity where only partial immunity was intended. Three, it renders meaningless the affirmative defenses. And four, it makes no sense as a policy matter because...
Let's talk about your second reason first. Mm-hmm. You just asserted that that counsel's interpretation frustrates the purpose of the legislature and the governor. That seems to presuppose that the legislature and the governor had a unified purpose. Is there any reason to believe that to be true given the history of this bill?
I think unified would be too strong a word. I think very similar would be more accurate. If you look at the governor's veto power.
The president of the Senate signed a bill, sent it to the governor for the governor's signature, that provided for the legalization of an activity. The governor, in your presentation, the governor vetoed sections that accomplished that purpose. So it appears to me that they were at varying, that they had varying intents with regard to what bills should become law.
And I think if you look simply at the result, you're right, there are differences between what was sent to the governor and what came out of the governor's office. But if you look at the governor's veto statement, it's clear that I would characterize this as a reluctant veto. The governor shared most of the aspirations of the legislature here, and simply because there was an intervening event, i.e. the United States Attorney sending a letter saying that we can't guarantee your employees are going to be exempt from federal prosecution, the governor had to take a step. And so the step the governor took was to excise from the law that portion that would place state employees at risk, but attempt to preserve as much as possible of the intent and the law as drafted by the legislature. That's why I say here I think what you have is a situation that's much different than what you have in a lot of gubernatorial vetoes, where the governor is simply, where the governor and the legislature see something on a policy level in a different way.
How do we deal with the treatment of the two various statements of purpose? In the bill as presented to the governor, section 101 and 102 were both statements of purpose. Section 101 was a new statement of purpose, and section 102 was a modification of a pre-existing statement of purpose that already existed within the revised Code of Washington.
Right.
How do we view the fact that the governor vetoed one, left the other intact, and thus it now became codified by the code reviser?
Well, the governor vetoed 101, which is the section that most directly referred to the registration requirement. And since she was vetoing the registration requirement in its total, I think it made sense that she vetoed that particular section, that statement of intent that dealt that was a standalone section. But I think that all of this falls into place if you look at the overall intent of the legislature in drafting this bill. And as I say, it's an intent that I think was shared by the governor.
Well,
and that is to
in telling me about the legislature's intent, are you going to complete an answer in telling me about the purpose statement that was not vetoed?
You mean 102?
Well, it seems to me the best indication of the intent of the legislature is to read their statement of purpose that actually becomes law. So why don't we start there? Council contends that that's a dirty trick on the citizens, that purpose statement exists in law because it can mislead them.
Well, actually, Your Honor, there was only one purpose statement, as far as I can tell, in the actual bill. And the other purpose language was left over from the 1998 legislation, I guess, or perhaps a carryover from 2007.
Was it not modified, though? I thought it was modified, and the modification remained because she did not want to veto.
I am looking at 101.
101 she vetoed.
Sorry?
101 she vetoed.
Correct. And then 102 are legislative findings that have to do with the whole scope of information, but it's not a statement of intent in the same way that 102 is. So I think you have two legislative intents. One is from the old bill, one is from this new bill. And what I was trying to get to, Your Honor, is I think that the way that you have to look at this statute is it creates a conditional status, a conditional immunity, for lack of a better term. And the statute on its face makes that plain. It says, you will not be arrested or prosecuted or searched if, and then it lists a series of conditions. Now, as it turns out, one of those conditions cannot be realized. But if you recognize what the legislature was doing here, was trying to set up a two-tiered approach where you have, one, a very protected status, but it was subject to conditions, and then you have a lesser protective status that was similar to what existed under the old law. Once that two-tiered approach can't be realized, the question becomes, what are we left with? Do you transform that first tier into some new law that provides even broader protection than anybody interpreted, or under these unusual circumstances, do you try and best effectuate the intent of both the legislature and the governor and recognize that if you have two-tiered system and one tier is not possible, then you fall back to the second tier? And I think that...
Do we care about effectuating the legislative intent of the legislature and the governor, or do we only care about effectuating the legislative intent of the governor?
I think you have to look at both, because when the governor...
Is there any legislative history from either the House or the Senate on the bill as enacted?
Well, I'm not sure if you're looking at legislative history that you're limited to the bill as enacted, because the, you know, if you look at that statement of intent, it says this act, you know, intends to make designated providers complying with the terms of this act and registering with the Department of Health basically immune from interference from the state. And just because that was stricken from the legislation, sure, it doesn't become part of the statute. But I think when you're looking at the intent of both the legislature and the governor, you can look at both of those things. And especially under these unusual circumstances where the governor, at the very beginning of her veto statement, makes it plain that she shares that aspiration. But she just says it can't be done now. I mean, and it's not that different from, say, for example, you know, we know that these regulations weren't going to go into effect until January of 2013, I believe it was. If the Department of Health, and this crime took place in April of 2012, I believe, so if the Department of Health and the Department of Agriculture had not produced regulations as of that point, there would be no registration. And that doesn't mean that somebody has blanket immunity, has blanket protection to do whatever they want under the guise of being a medical marijuana user. What it means is that for the time being, they rely on the affirmative defense. It's a two-tiered approach. So if the first isn't possible, you go to the second. You know, it's also possible that the communication from the U.S. Attorney's Office may have come after the governor signed her bill. Under those circumstances, the governor would have been left by perhaps executive order or some sort of other official act with excising that portion and saying, we are not going to carry out the mandate that's in the bill because it will expose our employees to prosecution, federal prosecution. Under those circumstances, again, this two-tier approach would not be effectuated, but it doesn't mean that the legislature or the governor, or certainly both together, intended a broader immunity than was originally crafted into the statute. It just means that you have to fall back on the affirmative defense for the time being. To the extent it's relevant, and I concede only marginally so, there are two bills that are competing in the legislature right now. Neither one of them contemplates the kind of open-ended immunity that counsel is arguing for here. Both of them tie this sort of immunity to identifying yourself up front. And the reason they do that is you have to do that or else you break down the distinction. You break down the ability of police to enforce the distinction between illicit use and medical marijuana use. And so that's really, in the end, an absurd result that you come to if you adopt the defendant's position. I'll also note that under 030 of this bill, the legislature gave healthcare providers blanket protection from search by the very terms of the language. And if you compare that language to the language in 040, it's very similar, except one has blanket protection from search, this one doesn't. And I think taking all that together, it's clear the legislature intended a two-tier approach. The first tier fails, you fall back on the second. Thank you.
Quickly, I'd like to get back to the governor's veto message and legislative intent. I think it's important to remember that with a criminal statute, we look at ambiguities differently. We have to look at parceling through the governor's veto by first thinking about the rule of lenity. This is a criminal statute imposing criminal penalties on patients, and as a result, we hold the state. You know, we construe a statute strictly against the state and in favor of the accused. And that, first and foremost, is controlling before we parcel through governor's veto and, you know, we look at legislative history and bill digest. We look to the rule of lenity first. I'd also like to
Why do we look to the rule of lenity first?
I mean, I think generally why we have the policy of the rule of lenity in the first place, we place the burden on the legislature to clearly and unequivocally warn people of the actions that expose them to liability. And
so
that...
So you're saying first you look at plain language.
Yes.
So plain language would not eliminate the language that you want eliminated as surplusage, because that's a rule of construction. So if we look at plain language, it has the registration language in there.
Yes, but...
You don't get it both ways. You don't get a rule of construction which says eliminate obsolete language, then read it, then see if it's ambiguous, and then apply the rule of lenity.
With all due respect, I disagree. I think that when the governor vetoed the registry language, any reference to the registry in the remaining unvetoed sections was also incidentally
that
vetoed.
That is a rule of construction. The plain language of the bill as enacted includes those words.
Well, then if we were to see there's an ambiguity and we looked beyond the plain language, then we'd look to the rule of lenity first and foremost.
Before we would resort to any other rules of construction?
Well, I think other rules of construction also support this, that in fact it's a remedial statute. My briefing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.